Welcome back, Michael Warren Thomas here. It's the Grapevine at SaverLife.com and a change for the Brighton Farmers Market. They are going to be, instead of at Brighton Farmers Market today, at Temple Beth Kodesh on Elmwood Avenue, right nearby, but this is 1 week only, and usually happens some point during the summer. There's some event or some, maybe the paint the lines at the sidewalk or on the parking lot. I'm not sure what it is at Brighton High School parking lot, but they have moved the market just for today. And so if you perhaps it's 9 a.m. right now, maybe you are just arriving and wondering why there's no one at the Brighton High School parking lot for the market. It is at Temple Beth Kodesh, 9 to 1. Today is the weekly farmers market, and lots of really cool, vegetables, fruits, things. All it's a great harvest time of the year. Tons of things available, and peaches are now widely available. Blackberries. I saw a post from Herd Orchards. They've got tons of blueberries. You can pick your own. Not today. They pick your own at Herd Orchards is Thursday, Fridays, Saturdays. But you can make an appointment for this coming week. It's going to be a hot start to the week, but by the later in the week should be beautiful temperatures for picking fruit. And blueberries are so easy to pick. And again, you make an appointment and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you can go out and pick a whole variety of things at Herd Orchards. I think the high is about 80 later in the week, so it'll be 85, 87, 89 the next couple of days, but not quite as hot later in the week. And, of course, all kinds of squash. Lighthouse Gardens has carrots now. There's tremendous fruits and vegetables available. And I saw some posts from John John's Bakery. They have a bunch of treats ready for you today at the Brighton Farmers Market. They're amazing, amazing chocolate cake. It's his grandmother's recipe, and it is the darkest chocolate cake you've probably ever had, and some buttercream frosting to go with it. It should be spectacular. So lots of neat things at today's Brighton Farmers Market, but it is in a different location. So Temple Beth Kodesh, Elmwood Avenue, it's just around the corner from the Brighton High School parking lot. There's an article I mentioned yesterday on the food show, or maybe on the Finger Lakes show, about Finger Lakes wines. This is an article from an English wine writer. It's the-buyer.net, Peter Dean, and pretty well known in England, I believe. And he's writing about Finger Lakes wines. This is the first of two articles that he's going to do, which should be really interesting to see. This one focuses on Rieslings. The second one is going to focus on more unusual wines. And he does give a shout-out to French-American hybrids, so I expect some of those to appear in his second article. But this one, he says, and I'm happy to send you the link. If you can't find it, send me a note, michael@saverlife.com. I'll get this to you. And so the byline of it is, a Peter Dean tastes through a range of Rieslings from old hands and young guns and picks out six that you should have on your radar. And he says, there are few wine regions in the world right now that are pushing the envelope quite like New York State. Wineries are setting up in a range of rural and urban setups with bewildering speed and with a bewildering array of grape varieties. It's almost as if, having been shackled by restrictive post Prohibition state laws and hindered by wine image problem, New York is trying to make up for lost time. Says there are some genuinely exciting wines from Abe Schorner's biodynamic Macari Chardonnay, made in downtown Brooklyn. Blau Frankish from the Channing Daughters, which is Long Island. All manner of stylish Cabernet Francs through to Forge's 11 single vineyard Rieslings made at Seneca Lake by iconic Rhone producer Louis Barol. Owns Chateau Saint-Côme in Gigandas. And that's not even taking into account a quarter of the wines that are heirloom, French-American hybrid varieties that appear hardly anywhere else in the world. So I think those are part two of this article, and looking forward to that. So he says it's wine geek and Somme heaven in the Finger Lakes. So again, this first article has a number of Rieslings that he highlights. The Red Newt Cellars Dry Riesling. A couple paragraphs about that, some details about the wine itself, and Herman J. Wiemer's Dry Riesling. The Red Newt that he reviews is 2015, which is interesting. I don't think he mentions why he's gotten older. Red Newt does sell some older vintages more than most wineries, but doesn't mention why he's got the 2015, because the one from Wiemer is 2018, and I think most of the others are 2018 also. So most of these six Rieslings are 12-13% alcohol, which is kind of normal for dry Riesling in the Finger Lakes. Dr. Constantine Frank's Dry Riesling, and he talks a little bit about the background of Dr. Frank in this article. And again, some nice descriptions of the wine, kind of sommelier-driven descriptions. Specifically, Dr. Frank's Riesling, it says very pale green gold on the eye, on the palate. The wine is light to medium with notes of pink grapefruit, zest, lime, candied citrus. The wine is deceptive, although the nose is complex. The palate feels subtle almost before opening out in the mouth and delivering that distinct cucullake minerality, which manifests itself like crushed rocks and lime-driven acidity on the finish. So that's Dr. Frank's, the Dry Riesling Classique from Forge Cellars. That's also a part of this at 12% alcohol. But then he reviews several other Rieslings that are much lower alcohol levels, more Mosel German style lower alcohol. Osmote, which does not have a winery tasting room, but wines are available at retail locations. And I think FLX Provisions carries them in Geneva. Osmote, I think, was initially known maybe more for Chardonnay, but they do have a Riesling. And this is only 9.7% alcohol. You know, that's substantially below 12-13%. That is more normal. So this will be a semi-dry, most likely, with that lower alcohol. Usually those are semi-dry Rieslings. And the Nathan K., his 2017 Dry Riesling, that's 10.7%. And some nice descriptions of these. A little bit about the wine as well as the winemaker, a little bit about the history of the wineries. So those are the six that he chose to review for this article, and look forward to seeing which six more unusual wines. Actually, maybe I'll try to figure out which ones he might write about. That could be kind of interesting. I don't know if I'll get any of them right, but might be a nice exercise in which of the French-American hybrid wines from which wineries he might explore. I'm guessing he might choose the Leon Malot from Cucullake Vineyards, because that's really unusual. No one else in the Finger Lakes makes a Leon Malot. He also could go with some of the blends, Save All Chardonnay blends, that are really delicious. And French-American hybrid grapes are less expensive to grow, much less expensive. We'll see that in the fall when the juice plants are pressing and you pay $18 a gallon for Riesling and you pay $6 a gallon for a lot of the French American hybrids. Third the price. And, that translates directly into what commercial wineries pay for them, but it's probably, somewhere along that range. So if you can blend a French American hybrid and make a really delicious wine that's gives you a wine at a lower price point and maybe a higher profit point, hopefully, because again the vinifera grapes are harder to grow, more tender, and French American hybrids, some of them are relatively hard to grow. Bacco, I guess some wineries are stopping or growing less Bacco because it can be hard to grow. But again, generally higher yields and varieties that you probably don't recognize, but you should still be tasting them. In fact, I'm far more likely to taste wines I don't recognize or I seldom see first before I taste Rieslings and Chardonnays and Cabernets. There's lots of those. Why not look for Taraldego and Zweigelt and, Segrebe and all these other fascinating grapes that, you may or may not like them, but you'll have fun trying them. And that's the beauty of visiting the wineries and visiting their tasting rooms. You don't have to buy a bottle. You can just taste some and see which are some of your favorites. And if it turns out that some of these French American hybrid wines that you really like them, and sometimes they're blended and sold as red table wines, and often some of the least expensive wines at the wineries, you may find some great values in those French American hybrids. There was a note from the Seneca Lake Wine Trail talked about quite a bit yesterday. They were explaining to people on Facebook and social media in general about the tasting fees and the fact that these have gone up in the Finger Lakes, probably around the country, wineries. And there are wineries in all 50 states, but wineries are facing more expenses, lower income, lower sales. And so the tasting fees have gone up a few dollars. And the article says, before the pandemic, most of them were maybe $5 to $7 per person. Now perhaps they're closer 8 to 10. There are some wine experiences and more extended sort of educational and often includes some opportunities like the Constantine Frank, and those tours and tastings and pairings, those run I think $75 per person, but some really very cool opportunities to taste and do things at the winery. And I think those tours in particular, because of their sparkling wine cellar in the 1886 building, are you're going to finish that and think that this was a pretty good deal, $75. It sounds like a lot, but for entertaining and with a really knowledgeable person, I think you'll go away from that feeling like it was and we have this combination of sense of history along with kind of cutting edge winery practices. So you may pay more for tasting. Some wineries will take some or I don't know if they take all of it, some might half of that amount off a price of, so it may take that you like. That's pretty unusual. I would think you'd probably find one of those that you would like, and bottles of wine might be $15 or $20, some a little less, some more, but in that $15 to $20 range. And it seems, when I've gone out and done tastings, it just seems kind of like the polite thing to do is to get a couple bottles when you visit a winery. I mean, I mentioned yesterday, you really shouldn't try to go visit 6 or 8 wineries in a day anyway. So if you're going to, say, 3 wineries, 1 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, you buy 2 bottles of winery, you end up with 6 bottles that you're taking home. That's kind of nice. You could get half a case at each of those wineries and have 18 bottles that you're bringing home for family, for friends, for special meals, for gift excuse, lots of great excuses to give someone a bottle of local wine. And our shipping, this continues to be a really crucial part of their revenue stream, because while tourism is higher than it was in, say, May or even June, it's still not anywhere near normal for the season. It's way, way down, partly because of restrictions from other states, but also people are just being careful, not traveling as much. So the wineries, the restaurants are really struggling still. And Gene Pierce posted in his Glenora Gazette that California was reporting some lower than normal harvest projections, and sort of implying that that was the California wineries were, the article, I guess, implied that was maybe a good thing, because sales are lower. They don't really need a bumper crop this year of lots of extra juice and potentially wine. So one of the strange things that Gene mentioned that happens every year at this time, it's a New York State regulation that wineries, or not wineries, but grape producers, sometimes wineries, sometimes just vineyard growers, they have to post their prices of their grapes for the season by, I think, August 15th, which seems weird. I mean, why? I'm not sure why they have to do this. It dates, it's a regulation that dates way back, probably. I'm not sure about prohibition, but perhaps this was a law that was trying to protect the grape growers because of games and things that the big wineries like Taylor may have been playing back in the 70s and 80s, or it probably goes back maybe 60s or 70s. I'm not sure. But it's an odd law, and it doesn't take into account the fact that things can change between now and harvest. I said last week harvest is only a few weeks away for a few varieties, the earliest varieties like Aurora, maybe end of August, early September. But most of the grapes aren't going to be harvested till late September, October. And what if we have rain every day in September, October, which has happened, and the quality of the grapes goes way down? What if it's beautiful weather and the quality of the grapes just gets better and better, and some of the best grapes that we've had? The growers can't change their prices. It's an insane law. It doesn't make sense these days. Although I haven't heard anyone say anything positive about it. Maybe there are some advantages, but again, having to post your prices easily, generally 2 months before some of the main harvest, which would be mid-October, is crazy. We can have hailstorms, we can have drought, we can have floods, we can have all kinds of weather issues that are going to change the crop, going to change the quality of it, which is really, that's the key. Most grapes in the Finger Lakes and in New York State are still sold based on tonnage. So the amount that's harvested, that the grower is protected by that, I suppose. The amount that's harvested is less likely to change. It's more the quality that's potentially going to change. And there are a few vineyards which sell grapes based on acreage. So this is so we're getting away from the idea of producing as many grapes as possible to producing potentially higher quality grapes and smaller quantities. So some wineries that own their own vineyards might go through and cut off a lot of bunches of grapes during the summer to concentrate the flavors. And there's some debate about how well this works, but the idea is that fewer grapes will give you higher quality grapes, and it probably varies a lot based on variety, but that's one of the practices that's pretty commonly used. And if you're a grower and you're selling grapes to a winery, you don't want to cut off a quarter of your grapes. I mean, that's that is money out of your pocket. So to encourage growers to do that when needed, a winery might pay by acreage instead of by tonnage, but that is still really uncommon. So again, by August 15th, wineries or anyone who's growing grapes to sell commercially has to post their prices. And judging from Gene's comments, he'd love to see that changed. It just doesn't make sense these days. It's there just isn't the impetus to change it, perhaps. So people talk about it each year, and it just ends up staying the way it is. Just one of those odd things that you he has a funny comment. He says that this regulation did not originate in China, but in Albany, and after decades, there still has not been a cure developed. So Gene's been in the wine business a long time, so I've got to find out from him exactly why this regulation came about. But my guess is it was to protect grape growers from the big wineries that really, this was when there was Taylor and Great Western and Gold Seal, and the growers really had very little to say, and the wineries would sometimes drop the prices that they were paying drastically, and they were bringing in juice and things from California. So, that's why Walter Taylor had his tank car, railroad tank car up on the hill, and was decrying all the juice coming from California. And when the wineries here did that, and then they were just the big wineries, there were very few wineries, then the growers couldn't even afford to harvest their crops. And this was in the 1970s. That's when the Wine Farm Wine Act was passed, which changed the Finger Lakes forever, really by allowing small grape producers, vineyards, to start their own wineries, and not face the regulations of a commercial winery or the just it made it much more reasonable, not really that much simpler, I guess, but much more reasonable cost and regulation-wise for a small business to start a winery. And it was that Farm Wine Act that really launched the current Finger Lakes wine industry and New York State wine industry. This was not just a Finger Lakes issue. This was statewide. So, but again, some of these regulations have stuck around for some reason. So hopefully I'll have a more of an update on how this regulation came to be, and perhaps next week. Also, I yesterday alluded to a piece, and this was an opinion piece CNN posted, and this is about restaurants, and it is John Avalon did the article, political analyst at CNN, and interviews Donnie Media, co-owner of Chicago's Blackbird. That restaurant has closed its doors now. It is closed for good. And Marcus Samuelson, another famous chef, is quoted here right at the start of it, saying 4 out of 5 of our favorite independent restaurants may not survive the shutdown. And this is, again, recent article. This is not, from the April and May shutdown. This is right now, as many states are having to shut things down once more. The article says the independent restaurant owners face an economic apocalypse. Together, they make up 500,000 small businesses across the country, directly employing 11 million Americans, with an economic impact that's felt up and down the supply chain from farmers to fishermen. And the article says most survived on small profit margins before COVID-19 crisis compelled many to temporarily close and reopen at 25% capacity, operating with skeleton crews, doing takeout, serving food outdoors when the weather permits. Now they're trying to convince Congress to throw them a much-needed lifeline in the form of the Restaurants Act, a bipartisan bill to establish a $120 billion grant program distributed through the Treasury Department. The stimulus and aid packages are caught in the political turmoil of Washington. This has not moved forward. But the end of the article, I thought, was especially well put. This he says this the things right now are really on edge. Quoting Michael Shumtov of Butcher and Bee Restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. Just about everyone is at the end of their federal Paycheck Protection Program funds. This is the moment, and so many people are waiting and watching, and they're going to make the decision whether they're going to fight or fold based on what Congress does. Says it's a, and this is John Avalon, the author of the opinion piece. This is a jump ball moment for our local restaurants and the communities they serve. Once the weather turns cold, the outdoor seating workarounds will no longer be operative, and without a vaccine, many will be forced to close their doors forever. You can't unring that bell. Those closed storefronts will make our communities less safe and less distinctive. But if Congress acts, it can help these small businesses survive and thrive. I'm not sure about the thrive part of it, but I'll take survive. And and even the Paycheck Protection Program had a lot of problems for restaurants. They had to bring back, I think, 75% of their staff or something in order to qualify. And, again, having a skeleton crew, you're not making money if you're bringing back that much of your staff. And you can protect those paychecks, but if you're not making money, then how long does that last? Right now, restaurants, at least in upstate New York, are at 50% capacity indoors, and that is that's not a level that's going to allow them to survive and make money. So I'm not sure there's much the individual can do at this point. Calling your U.S. senator or congressperson, I'm not sure how much difference that makes right now. It doesn't appear Congress will act, and this is going to hit restaurants, independent restaurants, particularly hard. The chains may well survive just because of deep pockets and the way they're structured, and they have perhaps more leverage with leases and banks, et cetera. It's the independent restaurants that are really in more and more dire straits. So if you're not comfortable dining indoors, and as I said yesterday, I'm not really that comfortable doing that myself, get takeout. Got some wonderful food from the King and I, from Lucano, from Vula's, from a variety of restaurants over the last several weeks, and that takeout is one way to help support them. Let you know, and pass the word about some of your favorite restaurants, and I encourage people to get takeout if they're not dining in. If you have some favorite restaurants, send me an email, michael@saverlife.com. Again, today the Brighton Farmers Market is changed locations. It's at Temple Brith Kodesh on Elmwood Avenue and not at the Brighton High School parking lot. That's just for this week, just for today. And I hope you get a chance to visit all the farm markets and farmers markets. I was posting about them at Rochester Food Net on Instagram, and check out Rochester Food Net for articles about what's happening. And restaurants, food, honey, one of the more recent posts by Karen Cross Smith. Go to rochesterfoodnet.com. We'll be back on Saturday with Gardening Restaurants, Discover the Finger Lakes here at saverlife.com. Have a great day.